Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.21, The Sacred Committee. Last time, we traced the origins of the Ottoman Freedom Society, a secret revolutionary organization formed by patriotic Muslims living in Salonika, who had been driven to take radical action as a result of the apocalyptic chaos gripping Macedonia and the looming threat of a great power intervention in the region. Following the Ilinden Uprising, which represented the apex of this chaos, Russia and Austria-Hungary had issued the Mersteg Agreement, which placed European advisors throughout Macedonia, allegedly in an attempt to maintain order and to protect the lives of religious minorities. However, the presence of these European officers simply put the Muslim population of the Balkans on high alert that the great powers might be trying to turn Macedonia into a colonial satellite, or that they might even try to annex Macedonia outright. The loss of Macedonia to a great power, or to one of the emergent Balkan nation-states like Greece or Bulgaria, was a completely unacceptable proposition for patriotic Ottomans. And so, young Muslims would begin to resist this process, and some of the most important figures of the Revolution of 1908 would emerge from this radicalized generation, and they would begin their political careers within the newly formed Ottoman Freedom Society. As we discussed last week, some of the most important people were the revolutionary mailman and future dictator, Talat, the economist and future minister of finance, Javid, and finally, the young officer and future founder of the Turkish Republic, Mustafa Kemal. The formation of the Ottoman Freedom Society was a critical development in the history of the Young Turk Revolution, because it marked the moment in which an internal revolutionary organization developed within the empire itself. And even more importantly, this society cultivated strong connections with the military. The emergence of an internal organization with connections to the military was important because, even though the Committee of Union and Progress had originally formed in Istanbul in 1889, ever since the Sultan sent, like everyone even loosely associated with the CUP, into exile in the 1890s, the Young Turk opposition had largely become an intellectual movement in which political exiles living in Geneva, Paris, and Cairo, just like bickered with one another over the best way in which to challenge Abdulhamid's persistently unchallenged rule. But while Muslims within the empire, such as Talat, Javid, and Mustafa Kemal, were beginning to form revolutionary cells throughout 1905 and 1906, there were also important developments happening outside of the empire within the Young Turk emigre circles. And ultimately, the revolution will be made once the Young Turks in the CUP operating in Europe merge with the revolutionaries of the Ottoman Freedom Society operating within the empire. This merger of the CUP leaders living in exile with the leaders of the Ottoman Freedom Society organizing within the empire will lead to the emergence of the legendary and somewhat mystical Sacred Committee, which will form the nucleus of the Revolution of 1908, and which will dominate Ottoman politics after the revolution from its headquarters in Salonika. And then the Sacred Committee will lead the empire through to its final collapse in 1922. Following 1908, the Sacred Committee in Salonika will come to operate somewhat like the Politburo of the Soviet Union. However, the power of the Sacred Committee would remain rather secretive, especially in its early years, and the internal politicking within the Sacred Committee would remain largely unknown to the Ottoman public, and it's all still pretty obscure to historians to this day. But what is quite clear is that the three dominant personalities of this Sacred Committee would be Talat, who we introduced last week, as well as the two political doctors, Dr. Nazım and Dr. Şakir, who are the focus of today's episode. As of 1906, Talat was emerging as the leader of the Ottoman Freedom Society, organizing revolutionary cells within the empire itself. Simultaneously, these two political doctors, Dr. Nazım and Dr. Şakir, were in the process of taking over and completely reorganizing the CUP Young Turk movement operating in Europe. And as we're about to see, the reason that Talat, Nazım, and Şakir would become such important figures is because they would initiate the merger of these two movements, fusing the internal and the external organizations into one much more powerful group. Very generally speaking, the external organization of Young Turk Emigres would provide the internal organization with access to their journals as a propaganda tool and offer them a basic ideological program. This ideological program was essentially Ottomanism plus the Midhat Constitution. And then, because Ahmed Reza had remained at the center of the exile movement for over a decade now, the positivist and anti-imperialist scholar continued to heavily influence this working ideology, as the Young Turks would continue to put a focus on rationalizing the government through Western-style reform, while at the same time resisting great power intervention. This was the old, use the tools of the enemy in order to prevent the enemy from taking over your empire. The internal Ottoman Freedom Society, on the other hand, would provide the external Young Turks in exile with an organizational structure within the empire itself, something that these exiles had honestly been trying but failing to develop for many years now. So the coming together of the Young Turk emigres in Europe with the Ottoman Freedom Society in Salonika would be the critical link leading up to 1908, and it would finally bring together the primary organizers of the revolution, Talat, Nazım, and Şakir, and form the nucleus of the Sacred Committee. So what all this means for us is that we need to go ahead and catch up with the Young Turks in exile. As we just mentioned, at the same time that the Ottoman Freedom Society was forming within the empire, some pretty dramatic changes were simultaneously occurring within the emigre movement over in Paris, Geneva, and Cairo. These dramatic changes within the CUP and within the exile movement more generally would revolve almost entirely around the arrival of one single individual to the emigre scene in Europe. That individual is Dr. Bahattin Şakir. As we are about to see, Dr. Şakir would arguably do more than any other single individual to lay the groundwork for the 1908 revolution, as he completely reorganizes the CUP and transforms it from being an impotent and scattered group of bickering intellectuals to being a well-organized and highly disciplined revolutionary committee with the capability of actually challenging the Sultan. So we better go ahead and introduce Dr. Bahattin Şakir. Bahattin Şakir is a mercurial figure who can at times be a bit hard to pin down, because once the CUP comes to power in 1908, Dr. Şakir, along with his right-hand man, Dr. Nazım, would operate largely in the background as one of the great political puppet masters, secretly pulling the strings of power through his influence within the CUP's Sacred Committee in Salonika. And by the way, I know that I have given Dr. Nazım short shrift, and it's probably unfair for me to present him solely as a sidekick. But to me, Dr. Nazım has some serious sidekick energy, as he will essentially go from being Ahmed Reza's sidekick in Paris to being Dr. Şakir's sidekick, once Şakir begins to eclipse Ahmed Reza in importance. But anyways, just keep in mind that Dr. Nazım is also a very important dude, and he would operate right alongside Dr. Şakir as they both work to change the structure of the CUP and to reorient it towards a more activist and revolutionary platform. Okay, so even though Dr. Şakir and Dr. Nazım would be less visible than other figures like Talat and Enver, these two doctors would become some of the most influential voices in the Sacred Committee of the CUP operating in Salonika after the revolution. and throughout the Second Constitutional Era. The Sacred Committee would, like we have said, become the real center of power within the empire, even if this power was often equivalent to an unseen hand secretly guiding events. So, Dr. Nazim and Dr. Shakir would become the ultimate shadowy figures, leading a shadowy committee that would drive Ottoman politics from the shadows. Okay, enough with the shadows, but the point I am trying to get across is that Nazim and Shakir were very influential figures, but they would never really hold any significant positions within the actual government. Their power would always remain behind the scenes. And critically, the influence of Dr. Shakir and Dr. Nazim would perhaps become most pronounced amidst the crisis of World War I. And these two political doctors would, alongside Talat and Enver, act as the primary architects of the Armenian Genocide. Now, we are still a long way off from the genocide, and the empire is going to go through like a kajillion crises between now and then. But that is where we are headed, and we do need to keep in mind that many of the most important conspirators of the 1908 revolution would go on to be the central perpetrators of the Armenian Genocide. Now, it is not going to be everyone, and Javed, in particular, would stand against his old friend Talat when Talat turns towards genocide. But Dr. Shakir, Dr. Nazim, Talat, and Enver, all of them would be critical players in the Young Turk Revolution, and all of them would play central roles in the genocide of 1915. Bahadin Shakir was born in 1874 in the city of Sliven, which today is in central Bulgaria, but when Shakir was born, the city was still a part of Ottoman Bulgaria, meaning that, like Talat, Dr. Shakir grew up as a Muhajir refugee. And as a young boy, Shakir's family had been driven from their home and been forced to flee Istanbul when the Russian army invaded and occupied Ottoman Rumelia in 1878. So, much like Talat, Shakir's identity as a Muhajir refugee would stamp his later politics. From a young age, Shakir would also develop a fierce pride in being a Turkish-speaking Muslim from Europe, and he would strongly resent the Orthodox Christians who had driven his family from their ancestral homes. Bahadin Shakir was a very bright, talented, and driven young man, and after graduating from the Imperial School of Medicine in 1896, Shakir would land a job as the personal physician of a very important Ottoman prince named Yusuf İzzeddin. Prince İzzeddin was the son of the deceased Sultan Abdul Aziz, Sultan Abdul Hamid's uncle, whom you may remember had been dethroned in 1876 as part of Midhat Pasha's coup, and had then committed suicide in somewhat mysterious circumstances shortly thereafter. What this meant for the young Dr. Shakir is that he was now the personal physician of the Sultan's cousin, a prince who was second in line to the Ottoman throne. So, from early on in his life, Dr. Shakir would rub shoulders with some very important people, and he was able to get a glimpse into the inner workings of Sultan Abdul Hamid's government. The two royal cousins, Prince İzzeddin and Sultan Abdul Hamid, always had a tense relationship, and the ever-paranoid Sultan did not trust his younger and arguably more popular cousin. So, when Abdul Hamid became Sultan, he confined Prince İzzeddin to a palace in Istanbul and built a police station directly across the street, just to make sure the prince knew that he was in fact being watched at all times. So, this was the environment of palace conspiracy in which Dr. Shakir worked while he served as the personal doctor to Prince İzzeddin. It seems that Dr. Shakir had always been sympathetic to the Ottoman opposition movement operating in Europe under the leadership of Ahmed Reza. But oddly enough, Shakir would begin to directly correspond with leaders of the CUP only after he became acquainted with Ahmed Celaleddin. Now, this is odd because you may remember that Ahmed Celaleddin was the childhood best friend of Sultan Abdul Hamid. And the last time we talked about him was in the context of the mass defection of young Turks surrounding Mizanji Murad Bey, when Ahmed Jalaleddin, as the Sultan's top intelligence chief, essentially bribed a bunch of young Turk exiles and convinced them to take their old jobs back working for the Sultan. And well, in 1904, Ahmed Jalaleddin had been outmaneuvered by a rival in the intelligence service. And when he was dismissed by this rival, Ahmed Jalaleddin decided to take the opportunity to defect to the opposition. And so, this former intelligence chief and childhood best friend of Abdulhamid joined the Young Turks in 1904. Dr. Shakir became acquainted with Ahmed Jalaleddin right around the time he was fleeing to Europe, and Shakir would, initially through Jalaleddin, establish close contact with prominent Young Turks operating abroad, including Ahmed Reza and his sidekick, Dr. Nazım. While he was corresponding with the Young Turks in exile, Dr. Shakir became very close with his boss, Prince İzzeddin, and in June of 1905, Dr. Shakir essentially convinced the prince to donate a very large sum of money to the recently established Young Turk journal entitled Şura-i Ümmet. This journal, whose title, Şura-i Ümmet, means something like Council of the Islamic Community, and it had been started by Ahmed Reza in 1902, shortly after the first Congress of the Ottoman opposition. And in fact, this journal was started by Reza and his followers directly in response to the split that had taken place at the Congress between those in favor of a foreign intervention to dethrone the Sultan and those who stood against foreign intervention as a matter of national dignity. So, from the beginning, the raison d'etre of Ahmed Reza's new journal, Council of the Islamic Community, was anti-imperialism and Ottoman-Turkish patriotism. In 1905, Dr. Shakir convinced his boss, Prince İzzeddin, who shared Shakir's general opposition to the absolutism of his cousin, Abdulhamid, to donate a very large sum of money to Ahmed Reza's new journal. And shortly after this exchange of funds, the Sultan's secret police became privy to the central role that Dr. Shakir had played in this maneuver. So, predictably, the 30-year-old doctor was banished to eastern Anatolia. However, Dr. Shakir would waste zero time languishing in exile, and he quickly fled the Ottoman Empire, boarding a ship headed for Marseille. Then, in September of 1905, Dr. Bahadin Shakir would arrive in Paris, and he would immediately set out to transform the CUP and to turn Ahmed Reza's circle of emigre intellectuals into a true revolutionary committee with an activist platform. Shortly after his arrival in Paris, Dr. Shakir would hold a meeting with Ahmed Reza and other leaders of his coalition. Dr. Shakir would describe the results of this meeting as follows. Quote, "The organization was in the form of a nucleus of a committee with a couple of patriots in Paris and Egypt and some correspondents here and there. It was pursuing a, quote, evolutionary program. Upon joining my patriot friends in Paris, I informed them about the needs of the fatherland and the expectations of the people from the committee. I also proposed the addition of, quote, revolutionary principles to the evolutionary program. Thus, upon their acceptance of switching from passive enlightenment to an active program, the committee was reorganized and reestablished according to the principle of the division of labor." Now, what Dr. Shakir is referring to here is the classic divide between social evolution and social revolution, which we discussed in the context of Ahmed Reza's philosophy as a strict positivist in the tradition of the French sociologist Auguste Comte. As a quick reminder, Ahmed Reza, as a positivist, believed in the gradual transformation of society through the use of rational administration and the general application of science to social problems. So, historically, Ahmed Reza had been strongly opposed to revolutionary tactics, and you may remember that this opposition to revolutions had at times made him a bit unpopular, especially amongst the so-called activist wing of the CUP, who were obviously pro-revolution. So, the question then becomes, how in the world did Dr. Shakir just stroll into Paris one day and manage to completely alter the direction of the CUP and of Ahmed Reza's coalition, which had been committed to a gradual evolutionary program for like 10 years? Well, as we saw with the flight of Mizanji Mourad Bey, who was able to quickly gather a following simply because he was a teensy bit less opposed to revolutionary tactics than Ahmed Reza, the positivist hold on the oppositional movement was never as tight as he would have liked to believe. And when assessing the Young Turks in exile, one can get the impression that Ahmed Reza was simply the most charismatic and outspoken intellectual amongst a host of other intellectuals who just could not compete with Reza's stubborn and principled commitment to a specific ideology, positivism. In other words, Reza's longtime recognition as the leader of the Young Turk movement in a lot of ways came from the fact that he simply had the clearest program. And this program boiled down to reinstating the Midhat Constitution, specifically in order to bring the benefits of positivism, rationalism, and Western science more generally to the Ottoman Empire. This is all to say that a lot of Young Turks had grown frustrated with Ahmed Reza's stubborn clinging to a gradual evolutionary program, and many were ready to hop on board with anyone who might be willing to take a more decisive action. This frustration with Ahmed Reza was felt most strongly within this so-called activist wing of the CUP. As we discussed, one of the unexpected results of the split over foreign intervention at the 1902 Congress was that it produced an unlikely alliance between this activist wing and Ahmed Reza's circle at Meshvaret. This alliance emerged because these groups realized that they both deeply opposed foreign intervention of any kind. And Ahmed Reza's new journal, Council of the Islamic Community, was in many ways a product of this new coalition forged in opposition to foreign intervention. Anti-imperialism was the clearest ideological program of the journal. However, due to Ahmed Reza's anti-revolutionary stance, this alliance between the activists and Reza was always pretty shaky, and in the pages of Reza's new journal, a lot of seemingly contradictory articles were often published. On one page, Reza and his circle would strongly denounce violent revolutionary tactics, and then on the next page, members of the activist wing would publish articles calling on Muslims to rise up and violently overthrow the Sultan's regime. So, essentially, Dr. Shakir was able to quickly take control of the opposition movement operating in Europe because he was promoting these so-called revolutionary principles. This commitment to a revolutionary program made him appealing to the many, many people who had long been frustrated with Ahmed Reza's conservatism. And then, when this more activist approach was coupled with the fact that Dr. Shakir held a certain amount of clout as the personal physician of an Ottoman prince, the doctor became quite popular amongst Young Turks in exile, and he would use this popularity to completely reorganize the oppositional movement. Dr. Shakir's reorganization of the CUP was arguably the single most important development in making a revolution in the Ottoman Empire a real possibility. For over a decade, Young Turks had been doing a lot of different things to oppose Abdul Hamid, including publishing journals, holding congresses, attempting coups, trying to assassinate the Sultan, and on and on. But these efforts had always been pretty disjointed, and even though the CUP had existed for over 15 years at this point, it still was a pretty haphazard organization, especially when compared with some of the other revolutionary groups we have covered on this podcast, like the MRO and the Dashnaks. When compared with these Christian revolutionary groups, the CUP and the Young Turks more generally were pretty lacking when it came to things like party discipline, or having any sort of coherent organization with a clear chain of command and mode of operation. And well, Dr. Shakir was very aware of this lack within the Young Turk movement, and like the founders of the Ottoman Freedom Society, he was also heavily inspired by the patriotic discipline of the Christian revolutionaries in the MRO and the Dashnaks. So with the MRO and the Dashnaks as his inspiration, Dr. Shakir set out to transform the CUP and the Young Turk movement generally from being a loose-knit collection of intellectuals into a real-life revolutionary committee capable of launching a real-life revolution. Dr. Shakir would succeed in this goal, and his ability to completely transform the CUP into the organization that would launch the revolution of 1908 is, honestly, a remarkable feat. From the beginning, Dr. Shakir would try to build a big tent through his reorganization efforts, as he reached out to as many different oppositional parties as he could. This would include Prince Sabahaddin, who had been the leader of the pro-interventionist wing at the 1902 Congress, as well as the two Armenian parties, the Hunchaks and the Dashnaks. And something that seems honestly somewhat astonishing in hindsight is that a key confidant in Dr. Shakir's efforts to reorganize the opposition was the prominent Armenian journalist Diran Kalekian. This is astonishing because Diran Kalekian would be one of the first Armenians to be arrested in 1915 during the mass deportation of Armenian intellectuals that would mark the beginning of the Armenian genocide. The Ottoman leaders who would initiate this order were Talat, Dr. Nazim, and Dr. Shakir. So figuring out how in the world we get from here to there is a big part of our story. But for the time being in 1905, Dr. Shakir worked alongside the Armenian journalist Kalekian to try and bring together the Armenian parties with Ahmed Reza and the CUP, and hopefully they could get Prince Sabahaddin and his pro-interventionist wing on board as well. These initial efforts of Dr. Shakir were unsuccessful, and so the uniting of all oppositional parties had to be kicked down the road. Though, by the end of 1907, a tactical alliance between these three groups, the Dashnaks, the CUP, and Prince Sabahaddin, would be formed during the Second Congress of the Ottoman opposition. But after these earlier efforts had failed, Dr. Shakir decided to put all of his energy towards turning the CUP into a truly revolutionary party. After a close study of the CUP, Dr. Shakir diagnosed two primary problems plaguing the organization. First was the lack of a strong organizational framework, and second was a dearth of effective revolutionary propaganda. This diagnosis was influenced by Shakir's close study of the MRO, and specifically, Shakir made great use of an article written by Boris Sarafov, the old classmate of Gota Delchev and one-time leader of both the MRO in Macedonia and the supremacists in Bulgaria. So, the influence of the Christian revolutionary groups was very direct. When comparing the Young Turks with the Macedo-Bulgarian groups, Shakir noticed that the MRO had both an external group operating in Sofia, as well as an internal group operating in Salonika in Ottoman Macedonia. And this strategy of building an internal and an external group goes all the way back to the early days of Bulgarian liberation, when Vasil Levski built his internal revolutionary organization in Ottoman Bulgaria, which would eventually merge with the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee based in Bucharest, Romania. When compared with the Bulgarian and Macedonian revolutionary movements, the CUP had never really had any sort of effective internal organization. Dr. Shakir would compare this situation to a group of generals without an army. Dr. Shakir's plan was essentially to build an army for Ahmed Reza and the other Young Turk generals operating in exile. Dr. Shakir's plan to build an internal organization capable of carrying out a revolution would culminate in the merger of the CUP with the Ottoman Freedom Society. Now, I need to quickly note that during Shakir's reorganization of the emigre movement, the Committee of Union and Progress would briefly change its name to the Committee of Progress and Union, which, yeah, real creative, you guys. But basically, for reasons of bureaucratic minutiae, it made sense to use a slightly different name than the old CUP, which had kind of been in disarray ever since the split at the 1902 Congress of the Ottoman opposition. But for about a decade now, the opposition movement had essentially been synonymous with the name Committee of Union and Progress. So Shakir wanted to make sure to still use the CUP's notoriety when recruiting new members. And to make things even more confusing, the Committee of Progress and Union would change its name back to the Committee of Union and Progress after the revolution. So yeah, it's very confusing, but just a heads up that Shakir's reorganized group was technically called the Committee of Progress and Union in the years directly leading up to 1908. But I am just going to keep saying CUP in order to avoid unnecessary confusion. Man, these people and their names for revolutionary organizations, just pick one and stick with it, for gosh sake. But after reorganizing and renaming the CUP/CPU, Dr. Shakir got to work building an internal network. This process would begin by making membership in the CUP much easier to attain. And so people began setting up branches in different towns and cities throughout the empire. Many of these branches would enjoy a high level of autonomy, and people were allowed to create new branches, even if they just like vaguely opposed Abdul Hamid's autocratic policies. Unlike Ahmed Reza, Dr. Shakir was not super worried about ideological consistency. Instead, he was almost entirely focused on organization and on building a vast network of revolutionary cells. The details of everyone's idiosyncratic ideological beliefs could be figured out later. For now, Shakir just wanted to build a network strong enough to take on Abdul Hamid and his administration. So, when people established new branches and when new members were initiated, they would take a loyalty oath. But this oath was intentionally left super vague in order to create this big tent revolutionary coalition. The CUP also put a ton of effort into recruiting young people who were identified as having the potential to become what they were now calling self-sacrificing volunteers. In this description, the CUP would use the word fedayi, which as we know from the Armenian Resistance series means those who sacrifice. So, along with adopting the model of an internal and external organization from the Macedo-Bulgarian groups like the MRO, Shakir would also attempt to build an army of hyper-committed and hyper-disciplined fedayi in the style of the Armenian dashnaks and hunchaks. When Dr. Shakir went looking for these sorts of hyper-committed revolutionaries, he inevitably came across Talat, Javed, and others who were in the process of forming the Ottoman Freedom Society. Now, Talat and the other founders of the Ottoman Freedom Society were very aware of the CUP and its activities. Talat had been in correspondence with Ahmed Reza for years before he even founded his internal organization. And because the Ottoman Freedom Society lacked any sort of robust journal, leaders made extensive use of CUP propaganda in order to recruit and radicalize new members from the very beginning. But for about a year, the CUP and the Ottoman Freedom Society would kind of dance around each other like distracted lovers who knew their paths were bound to one day come together, but the time for a marriage was just not yet right. But then, in May of 1907, about 8 months after the founding of the Ottoman Freedom Society, two of the society's members, a captain and a first lieutenant in the Third Army, fled to Europe in order to avoid arrest. These two revolutionary officers immediately joined the CUP and began working directly with Dr. Bahadin Shakir. So, months before the two parties officially merged, there were already individuals who were a part of both organizations, showing how the CUP and the Ottoman Freedom Society had essentially the same goals and shared the same working ideology, with the primary difference between the two groups being mostly their base of operation, with the CUP operating abroad in Europe and the Ottoman Freedom Society operating in Ottoman Macedonia. Around this same time, in the summer of 1907, Talat sent a letter to Dr. Nazim, the right-hand man of Ahmed Reza, who is now quickly becoming the right-hand man of Dr. Shakir, And in this letter, Tala demanded a merger between his society and the CUP. So Dr. Shakir decided to dispatch Dr. Nazim into Macedonia in order to look further into a formal merger with Talat's internal committee. However, due to the now truly insane paranoia of Sultan Abdulhamid, the Ottoman Empire was a pretty tough place to enter, especially if you were a known oppositional figure like Dr. Nazim. So, Nazim had to first travel to Athens, Greece. And while in Greece, he actually met up with a group of Greek revolutionaries who were engaged in the ongoing guerrilla war against the Macedo-Bulgarians as part of the Macedonian struggle. Dr. Nazim was able to convince these Greek guerrillas to help him enter Macedonia, and so he boarded one of their fishing boats disguised as a teacher and successfully crossed the Ottoman border in mid-June 1907. Then, after briefly hiding out on a farm with these Greek guerrillas, Nazim would enter Salonika disguised as a peasant. At first, Dr. Nazim was a little bit skeptical of Talat and his group of conspirators. However, after a series of meetings, Dr. Nazim would send a letter to Shakir in late September, officially recommending a merger of the internal and external committees. Ahmed Reza, Dr. Shakir, and other CUP leaders would immediately accept this recommendation, and on September 27, 1907, the Ottoman Freedom Society and the CUP officially merged. So, the two groups would now operate under a single party structure and be known by a single name, which was, the Committee of Progress and Union, but again, I am just sticking with CUP. But even though the Ottoman Freedom Society was officially folded into the CUP, we should not think of this as the Ottoman Freedom Society being absorbed by the CUP. It really was a true merger, and the old members of the Ottoman Freedom Society, like Talat and Javed, would continue to operate as an autonomous unit. And the external organization under Dr. Shakir would continue to communicate directly with other branches operating internally within the empire, without having to go through the Freedom Society as an intermediary. But most of all, this merger represented the true birth of the Sacred Committee, with Talat, Shakir, and Nazim as its most powerful leaders. After the merger of the external CUP with the internal Ottoman Freedom Society, the organization as a whole, under the leadership of Dr. Shakir, began making concrete plans to launch a revolution. In this effort, the party would continue their reorganization as they sent out more formalized party regulations. And in line with the ongoing trend of using Christian revolutionary groups as their model, these new regulations pretty much just copied the internal regulations of the MRO and the Dashnaks. However, even though they were heavily borrowing their party organization and revolutionary methods, the end goal of the CUP was pretty much directly opposed to the Christian groups. To begin with, the CUP began to once more adopt an Ottomanist approach as they opened up membership to all Ottoman subjects, regardless of their religion or ethnicity. Furthermore, the CUP leaders stated that one of the, quote, principal duties of the committee was to, quote, hinder those who work toward creating discord because of their racial and religious desires. This language is somewhat coded, but essentially the CUP was turning itself into an aggressive revolutionary network whose principal aim was to combat revolutionary nationalism and separatism. This is a very important point, and it is key to understanding what the 1908 revolution would be all about. At this time in late 1907, the inter-ethnic violence of the Macedonian struggle was peaking as Bulgarian, Greek, and Serbian guerrilla bands were all facing off against each other in the hopes of increasing the influence of their respective nation-states amongst the Christian Slavic peasants of the Macedonian countryside. And as we have mentioned previously, what was getting lost in all of this was the fact that even though these Christian nation-states all pretty much took it for granted that it was only a matter of time until the Ottomans lost control of Macedonia, the Ottomans had not, in fact, yet lost control of Macedonia, and the patriotic Muslims living in Macedonia, especially those in the Third Army who spent most of their time fighting against these Christian guerrillas in an attempt to restore order in the region, well, they very much wanted to keep Macedonia in Ottoman hands. These proud Ottoman Muslims were not about to just sit idly by and allow Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia to carve up their homeland. No, just like the Christian revolutionaries, they planned to fight tooth and nail, not for liberation, but for the salvation of their fatherland. The types of people that the CUP began to target after the reorganization changed pretty dramatically under the direction of Bahattin Shakir. Since its founding, the CUP had spent most of its energy trying to recruit influential people, whether they be high-level bureaucrats, prominent religious scholars, top-tier generals, or princes from the Sultan's inner circle. But Dr. Shakir would point out the major flaw in this approach, saying, quote, "If a committee limited itself to choosing as its members such and such a renowned pasha, or such bey, or such such office director, as we have done so far, that committee would not find a single member ready to sacrifice himself to overcome the obstacles that it faces." So, pivoting away from this previous approach, the CUP would intentionally recruit more lowly members of society, the idea being that people down on their luck would have much less to lose and so be more likely to sacrifice their own health and safety for the sake of the committee. Essentially, Shakir wanted to build an army of young, militant, and radicalized fedayi willing to die in the name of the fatherland. In this effort to build an army of self-sacrificing volunteers, Dr. Shakir pushed the organization to begin by recruiting rank-and-file members in the military. So, the CUP began to publish articles in their journal, Council of the Islamic Community, which was increasingly falling under the leadership of Dr. Shakir. And these articles made direct appeals to the military, calling back to the glory days of the Ottoman Empire when the great Ghazi warriors of old came down from the plains of Central Asia and forged their great empire with blood and steel. Within this mythical language, there was a clear underlying message that the military was the only institution capable of carrying out a revolution that could truly reinvigorate the empire and bring it back to its former glory. The emergence of a radicalized military was the single worst nightmare of Sultan Abdulhamid. For nearly a century, the armed forces had not played a very significant role in Ottoman politics, really ever since Sultan Mahmud II did away with the Janissary Corps in 1826 as a part of the auspicious incident. But moving into 1908, the Sacred Committee, leading the now-merged CUP and Ottoman Freedom Society, would enjoy a lot of success in their efforts to infiltrate and radicalize the military. And so these sultans' worst nightmare would soon become a reality. So, next week we will follow this radicalization of the military, as more and more junior officers stationed in Macedonia join up with the CUP as self-sacrificing volunteers. In early 1908, these officers would begin to prepare themselves to take to the hills, should they feel the need to force Abdulhamid to resist a great power intervention, and to compel the Sultan to reinstate the Midhat Constitution in order to save the empire. Meaning that, in our next episode, we will get to meet some very important figures, as we introduce the officers who will provide the muscle for the revolution, the so-called freedom heroes of 1908, Ahmed Niazi, and of course, Ismail Enver. So, join me next time as we dive headlong into the Third Army of Macedonia.